From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, strange tales. Here's what's happening. Well, you might have noticed that the gas pump prices seem to be going up, up, up. Well, they really are. Gasoline analyst Patrick DeHaan has argued that the price at the pump is soaring due to increased demand, coupled with the fact that the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, is not opening the spigot yet. Keep our eyes on that. Senate Democrats approved the Biden administration's $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package, paving the way for a third $1,400 stimulus check for millions of Americans and households that could start to receive the money in just a few weeks. The American Rescue Plan will now head to the House for final approval, which could happen as soon as tomorrow. Once Congress approves the emergency aid bill, the president needs to sign the legislation to release the money. He's widely expected to do so before Sunday, when two key jobless programs are set to expire. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has released highly anticipated guidance on practices considered safe for those who are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus related to gatherings, quarantine, and testing. Of note, the Federal Health Agency said that those who are fully vaccinated can spend more time with unvaccinated people indoors with no mask, so long as those who are unvaccinated are at low risk for severe COVID-19. How about that? Well, they say that for most people of a certain age, their brains tend to see the big picture before setting in to focus on the details. Those growing up in the digital age, however, are being rewired to see the world a whole lot differently. Researchers in Hungary say children who start using digital services at a young age pay more attention to tiny details and less to the entire picture. How about that? At least 30,000 organizations across the United States, including a significant number of small businesses, towns, cities, and local governments, have over the past few days been hacked by an unusually aggressive Chinese cyber espionage unit that's focused on stealing email from victim organizations. Let's check in with our expert on the Internet, Lauren Weinstein. This is pretty widespread, Lauren, isn't it?
And it's worse than just email, too. What's apparently happened is that various versions of Microsoft Exchange Server were hacked, and that's Microsoft's its email calendar collaboration. It's the product used by firms from very small to global who have chosen to use Microsoft for such services. And we should note, many firms don't use Microsoft Server, so it's not like, you know, everybody's being impacted by this, so only the ones who have chosen to use Microsoft. But, yeah, it's about 30,000 estimated right now attacks and rising. No one really knows how many. And the hack opens up. Once it gets in there, it opens up all sorts of holes. So attackers have leverage to install other malware, do all sorts of other nasty things. Microsoft did release patches for this, but as usual with patches, many firms don't install them right away for a variety of reasons, some good and sometimes not so good. Some may not even know about the patches yet. So this is still on the upswing. And the scope of this hack is so large, it could well be the largest in recent history. So the federal government now considers this to be a priority matter to try to deal with this problem with Microsoft software. And especially, there's a particular concern, and this isn't necessarily a big surprise. This hack appears to be from a Chinese source, in this case a Chinese hacking group called Hafnium, which in the past has targeted all manner of think tanks and defense contractors and researchers and random places too. It's generally opportunistic behavior. They don't necessarily know what they're going to find, but they just want to find the good stuff that might be of military value or more often typically economic value.
Yeah.
And of course, once these kinds of vulnerabilities are in place, even though they were done by a particular group, once all these holes are open, other hacking groups then can exploit them for their own purposes. So it becomes a domino effect, and it's pretty bad.
Lauren, is our country doing the same thing to them?
I don't know the answer to that question. You know, the general trend in cyber security defenses has been to, in some situations, assume that the only way to fight back is with actual offensive attacks. The problem is, obviously, you can get into what amounts to a nuclear war, a nuclear cyber war, right? I mean, if you have escalating attacks back and forth, you can really get into some serious problems. So the other danger is sometimes it's not as clear as in this case what the source of the attack is. So if you do a offensive response and it turns out you're not hitting the actual culprit, then you have even larger problems. But certainly there has been a trend in recent years. The thinking has been there may be some situations where an offensive attack may be necessary. You know, that's the big carry the big stick philosophy.
Yep.
But it's a very, very delicate area. It's very controversial. A lot of it goes on in secret, of course, and a lot can go wrong.
All right, keep your eyes on the story for us. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the Internet. Once a week, astronomer Steve Cates joins us to talk about things in the sky, and here he is right now for this week's report. Hi, Stephen.
And hello there, George. We begin, of course, with space and with all the attention now on the Mars 2020 robotic Perseverance rover. George, this is interesting. NASA has but a short time to develop a new series of human spacesuits to deal with the reality of a return to the moon and future human Mars missions. But many, George, do not know that the current spacesuits for these particular missions are 1970s technology right now, so says NASA engineer Pablo De Leon, director of a lab, George, at the University of North Dakota, which is a NASA-sponsored project. NASA has not designed a new spacesuit since 1977, and he says we need to get a move on if NASA hopes to meet a 2024 manned lunar mission deadline. NASA needs a new spacesuit for spacewalks, and how about this, a new suit for surface exploration of the moon and beyond. He has two designs to be tested. One's called the NDX-1, that's for the Mars missions, and the NDX-2 for lunar missions. And George, this I find fascinating. The lunar missions, of course, with moon dust, they've found that moon dust can be abrasive and cut like glass. And for Mars missions, there's something in the surface of Mars soil called perchlorate, and that's toxic to humans. So serious concerns exist for the new development of spacesuits. We move on to astronomy, George. Look at the moon, right? It looks amazing most of the time, if not all the time. But many do not know that the moon actually has a tail. Yes, scientists now say that the moon exhibits a long comet-like sodium tail due to the pressure of sunlight hitting the lunar surface. And that this tail, George, even though it's invisible to the naked eye, is most pronounced when the moon reaches its due phase. This sodium moon tail is most powerful when the new moon is closest to Earth or some 5 hours after new moon. As it beams its sodium tail around the Earth's atmosphere in space, and meteor showers, George, which hit the moon, make the tail even more intense, so things get more complicated in the sky. But for all of us out there, George, the live sky is how we wrap it up, things that you can see. Last quarter moon was on the 6th. But now, folks, George, this is important. Look low in the east-southeast at dawn for the waning crescent moon, which is now closing in on both the planet Mercury, Jupiter, and Saturn. All these objects low in the east-southeast as early as the morning of the 10th. All objects will appear within 5 degrees separation, and the new moon, of course, the dark of the moon on the 13th. But finally, George, in dark skies at 9 p.m., the Milky Way runs nearly due south to north in your sky, and overhead, by around 9 p.m. on these early or mid-March evenings, the bright star Capella, some 43 light years away from us, the light left back in 1978, it's the sixth brightest star in the heavens now, but it was the brightest star in the night sky some 200,000 years ago. Don't forget, email me as always at drskyshow@gmail.com. Always remember simply to keep your eyes to the skies. Always check out theskylive.com for more information. And George, always proud to be the show's navigator on the highway to the heavens.
Thank you, Dr. Sky. We'll talk to you next week. How did Elon Musk's SpaceX go from a shaky startup to one of the world's largest private space enterprises? How did it happen? In a moment, Eric Berger joins us. His latest work is called Liftoff, and we'll talk about this miraculous growth of this company in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Eric Berger with us for the next couple hours, reporter and editor based in Houston. And after a long career at the Houston Chronicle newspaper, he joined Ars Technica back in 2015 as the site's senior space editor covering SpaceX, NASA, and everything beyond. He was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for his coverage of Hurricane Ike in the Houston Chronicle area in 2008. He is a meteorologist as well. Eric, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to talk to you this evening, George.
Me too. We're going to have some fascinating discussions here with you. Before we get into your work, Liftoff, which was very well done, by the way, tell us a little bit about Elon Musk and how he started, how he made his money, and then how he got into the SpaceX program.
Yeah, Elon Musk was born in South Africa. By all accounts, was a pretty bright kid, and emigrated to Canada, and then studied to go to college, and then went to graduate school in the United States. You know, by the time he was in his 20s, he had a couple of Ivy League degrees in economics and physics, and started PayPal, sort of to help disrupt the banking industry. And so by around 2001, he had sold off his shares of PayPal and had about $180 million and was trying to figure out what to do next with his life. You know, he was only about 30 years old, and he'd had a full life by then already.
Was he always interested in space?
Yeah, that was always one of the big interests he'd had. And what happened was back in 2001, he was talking with a friend named Dale Resi about what he was going to do next, and he thought, well, he would check out and see what NASA was doing because he was interested in that. And he thought that by then, you know, more than three decades after Apollo, NASA ought to have a plan to send humans to Mars. And when he went to their website back then, they had nothing about a human plan to Mars. They were just building the International Space Station at the time.
Now, what came first for him, Tesla or SpaceX?
SpaceX came first. He founded that in May of 2002, and Tesla was about a year or two later after that.
Did he self-finance SpaceX in the beginning, or did he have venture capital money?
He did self-finance. He ended up putting $100 million into the company, and the idea would be that that would be about enough to get them for three flight attempts of a small rocket with a single main engine. It was called the Falcon 1. He would go on to get small government grants, you know, $5 million here, $2 million there, but it was mostly all his money.
He risked all that capital just in case, huh?
Yeah, you know, there's no joke in the space industry. If you want to become a millionaire, start a rocket company as a billionaire.
That's almost like the restaurant business too.
Exactly. But he started out, George, and it was his goal from the beginning to send humans to Mars. That was the plan, you know, back in 2002 when he founded SpaceX, and it sounded really, really audacious then. Today, maybe less so, but back then, that was pretty out there talk.
Is SpaceX, when it started off, even though he pumped $100 million into it, was on pretty shaky financial ground, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, even though that sounds like a lot of money, when you need to buy all the materials to make rockets, you need to hire very smart people to build them, and you need to build launch sites, $100 million doesn't get you very far. And, you know, and they initially had hoped to launch from California, from Vandenberg Air Force Base. But they ran into competition and bureaucratic red tape there, and ultimately, sort of at the last minute, were forced to find another launch site.
We're with Eric Berger. His book is called Liftoff. When you started following Elon Musk, what was it that got you interested?
It was just the different way he was doing things. You know, if you look around the space industry today, the companies like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, they're in it for the government contract. So they're not going to build something, be it a rocket, a spacecraft, a satellite, until the government gives them a contract to do so.
Right.
With SpaceX, it was, you know, we want to go to Mars, and we think we need to make lower cost rockets to do that. And so they started out with the Falcon 1, and they had the government wasn't paying for that. No customer was paying for it. That was their design, which was totally, really different than the way it was typically done in space.
Have you had a chance to meet Elon Musk?
Oh, yeah. I've spent many hours with him for the book, both in interviews and sitting in on meetings at the company to get a sense of how he leads. He's certainly an interesting guy.
Is he a genius?
He's extremely smart. You know, Over my career, I've had the opportunity to interview Stephen Hawking on several occasions. So I've been around smart people. Elon Musk is both brilliant and extremely driven.
How would you compare him to Jeff Bezos?
You know, there's it's funny you ask that. They're similar in that they're both successful successful people who are very interested in space travel. They're both engineers. I would say Elon is a better aerospace engineer. And certainly he has been more involved with SpaceX over the last 20 years than Blue Origin, or than Bezos has been with his rocket company called Blue Origin.
It's exciting. And at this point, they have, it seems like they've surpassed NASA, haven't they?
SpaceX has surpassed NASA in some areas. It is certainly safe to say they are NASA's most important contractor at this point. You know, they're launching humans into orbit for NASA, of course. They're launching cargo to the International Space Station. If we do succeed in going back to the moon, SpaceX will play an important role. They're much better at building rockets than NASA, much more efficient in that. And they now operate more satellites in orbit than any space agency or country in the world. So, yeah, they're better at a lot of things.
Eric, what did you learn about the early days of SpaceX in terms of their rocket technology?
Well, what they learned is that it's really hard to get something into orbit on the first time out. And they had to launch three times before they finally made it successfully. On the fourth time, they had three failures. So it was, you know, they learned a lot of hard lessons.
I mean, if you were an astronaut years ago and Elon Musk said, "Hey, I want you on one of my rockets," would you have gone?
Like everyone else, I probably would have laughed him out of the room and said, "You can't even get into orbit with a small rocket." You know, his first vehicle, the Falcon 1, could get a few hundred pounds into low Earth orbit. And you need obviously many tons if you're going to send a spacecraft capable of sending humans. So when he talked that way, you know, he had a spacecraft, a mock-up spacecraft in his old factory. He started out in El Segundo, and it was called Puff the Magic Dragon for reasons you might imagine. But the vision was always there. It took a while to fulfill it.
Well, he's the one laughing now, isn't he?
He absolutely is the one laughing now. You know, they really struggled until about 2010. And then since that time, they've done all these amazing things, landing rockets, you know, on autonomous drone ships, launching his Tesla to Mars and flying humans into orbit. It's in the last decade, they've really gone from David to Goliath in the aerospace industry.
Eric, did he get his $100 million investment back?
He got that back and much more. SpaceX today has a valuation, I think, during its most recent round of funding of about $75 billion.
Wow. Wow. I think Bezos probably has a little bit more cash. But
they've been going back and forth on the most valuable list. Bezos is ahead now, but you know, when Tesla was really high several months ago, Musk briefly was richer than Bezos. All of this is on paper, of course. He doesn't have the cash in a drawer somewhere.
What would you say is SpaceX's best achievement?
For me, it's the reuse of the first stages, George. I mean, if you think about it, you know, a rocket launches off the face of the Earth, and it's pushing a spacecraft that ultimately is going to be going 25 times the speed of sound.
Right.
And then you've got that first stage with these nine engines that is traveling many times the speed of sound, screaming through the atmosphere. And then you've got to get that vehicle back down to the ground on a little boat that's, you know, not much bigger. It's many times smaller than a city block. And it's got to light its engines as it's coming back through the atmosphere, and it's just an incredibly turbulent environment. And so it's got to light its engines, and no humans controlling it. It's all programmed. And so the drone ship is autonomous, the rocket's autonomous, and it all comes together, and you see these rockets slow down and then land in the middle of the ocean on the high seas. I mean, that to me was, it just feels like the future. Like we're stepping into the future when that kind of thing happens.
NASA never did it or even tried it. How come?
Well, they did some experiments in the 1980s and 90s with a program called the DCX. They had some successes and some failures, and ultimately the funding for it ran out. You know, they were flying the space shuttle, which was reusable, but it landed like an aircraft on a runway. It was much more expensive and a lot more difficult to refurbish that between flights. I think one of the reasons NASA didn't do it is because it was so risky. And Congress funds NASA, and it doesn't fund NASA to fail. And SpaceX had to, you know, they lost a lot of first stage rockets. I mean, all rockets up until that point were expendable, so there's nothing new. But they had to make a lot of misses before they finally hit it. And once they figured it out, they've gotten really good at it.
All right, stay with us, Eric. We're going to come back in a moment and talk more about your work, Liftoff, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Eric Berger with us. His book is called Liftoff. We'll take calls with Eric next hour. Eric, what was the most surprising aspect of SpaceX that you uncovered covering it over the years? What is that one thing that just boggles your mind?
It's really the desire by Elon Musk to go fast. In talking to some of the earliest employees and seeing how they go today, he wakes up every day with the idea of how can I get my companies to move more quickly. And he applies this constant pressure, George, that basically, you know, he will have a meeting on a Friday afternoon and, you know, come up with some kind of potential solution to a difficult engineering challenge. And, you know, he'll want an answer by Monday morning on how things went.
Yeah. Is morale good at that company?
It is. You know, when you go into his meetings and you see his executive conference room, and he'll have a meeting about a rocket engine or the Dragon spacecraft or the big Starship vehicle, you know, there will be a couple of people in their 30s and 40s sitting around that table, but mostly it's kids in their 20s, engineers right out of school.
Geniuses.
And they come to the company knowing that they're going to work really hard, right? 60, 70, 80, 90-hour weeks, and basically just give their lives over to this company. But it's a trade that most of them are willing to make because they realize that, you know, SpaceX is the place if you really want to do things on the edge of spaceflight, like we talked about, landing a rocket on a boat,
mm-hmm.
or building this Starship vehicle to go to Mars. There's nowhere else to do it because NASA, for all of the great things it does, is not moving quickly toward those kinds of goals. But at SpaceX, you have a chance to actually do them, and you're not worried about Congress or a new president coming in and canceling the program. The only person whose voice really matters is Elon's.
How many people does he employ now through just SpaceX?
SpaceX is about 6,500 employees, give or take.
And they're based out of El Segundo?
Well, they moved. The company was originally founded, and they had a small factory in El Segundo. In 2007, they moved to Hawthorne, California, which is down the road in L.A. But then now they have, you know, facilities at the launch sites in Florida. They've built a big engine test facility in central Texas. They've got this star base in south Texas at Boca Chica where they're building starships. So they're all over the place.
Is he going to get humans back to the moon or to Mars before NASA?
You know, that's a great question, and I think the answer is quite possibly yes, although more likely it probably will be in conjunction with NASA.
Sure.
I think he is building an excellent transportation system in terms of rockets and spacecraft, but to go to the moon and especially to go to Mars, it's so far. It's 6 months there, 6 months back. Lots of concerns about radiation.
Yeah.
You need power on the surface of Mars. You need habitats. And these are all things that NASA has studied for 20 years on the International Space Station. And so I think he's going to go with NASA, although if they don't move fast enough, he may just press on ahead by himself.
He's been launching these Starlink spaceships with these little satellites that go in lines. We've been getting calls on open lines sometimes, Eric, where people think, there are UFOs out there, George, and what they are is the cluster of his little satellites all over the place. What's he doing with those?
Yeah, so he'll launch 60 of these at a time, and they're about 300 pounds each. You know, each are about the size of a mini refrigerator or thereabouts. You know, he is trying to put thousands of these satellites up in low Earth orbit to send internet signals back to Earth. Now, we have big satellites at geostationary orbit. So this is, you know, 20,000 miles above the Earth's surface you know, provide communications, but there's lag because even at the speed of light, there's a delay. You at geostationary space, the satellite is always there. It's, you know, it's falling around the Earth at the same speed of the Earth's rotation, so it's always looking down at us. In low Earth orbit, the satellites are going much faster in terms of relative to the surface of the Earth, so they zip on by, and that's why people see them moving overhead. But it doesn't take light very long to bounce up to a satellite in low Earth orbit and come back, so you can get low latency internet. So he wants to deliver high speed internet from a constellation of satellites. It's called Starlink, and he's not alone. You know, Jeff Bezos has a Project Kuiper plan. Telesat has a plan. OneWeb has a plan. China's looking at a low Earth orbit internet constellation. So this is the future. He's just the first to really get up there because the Falcon 9 rocket can fly so often that he's able to move more quickly to deploy this.
Are there other countries that are trying to do similar things privately like Elon Musk is, or is he and Bezos standing all alone on this planet doing this?
There are other countries, like the European Space Agency is trying to do some of these things, but they move pretty slowly. The only real competitor in a lot of these areas right now is China, and that's because they have the resources to do it in terms of guaranteed funding, right?
Yeah, exactly, from us.
They set the budget, and then they have these long-term plans, and because the leadership never changes, they stick to their plans. So they are making strides. And what China did about 4 or 5 years ago, George, is they recognized the United States had an advantage with its commercial space industry because you had actors like Musk, Bezos, and other people doing really innovative things and doing it much more quickly than the government. So they licensed out their technology to quote-unquote private companies, which aren't really companies in the sense that they are here in the United States. But these companies then went out and raised money, took the government technology, are trying to move quickly. So if you look at some of these companies, like there's a Chinese firm called Galactic Energy, and their plan literally is to build rockets that look almost exactly like the Falcon 9. So China, both the government space corporation as well as these private companies, is doing things that sort of put it on par to try to catch up to what SpaceX has done in launch.
Is SpaceX launching now for private companies as well, in addition to contracting with NASA?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it was interesting. When SpaceX was founded, U.S. rockets had gotten so expensive because the big companies at the time were essentially reliant on launching military satellites to make their businesses profitable.
Right. And were they gouging us? Because they were exclusive, weren't they?
That's right. They had a Lockheed and Boeing had a monopoly on launch contracts. And so in the 1980s and 90s, all of those commercial launches you talked about. So like if Sirius wants to get a big satellite up in the geostationary orbit for communications or DirecTV or whatever, they would go to Europe and launch on an Ariane rocket, or they would go to Russia and launch on a Proton rocket. So the U.S. share of this commercial launch market was about 0%. And now, SpaceX, thanks to SpaceX, the United States launches about 60% of those satellites. And that's just because the Falcon 9 costs a lot less than those competitors.
Technologically speaking, Eric, how fast is technology in the space area moving?
It's moving a lot faster now than it was 20 years ago, that's for sure. And you know, we talked about how Elon Musk wants to go fast, and what's most remarkable, I think, is what they're trying to do with this Starship program. Now, they've blown up the last three. You may have seen these launches from South Texas where this vehicle goes up and does this belly flop, comes back down, and then tries to land, and then it explodes because this is all pretty experimental. But these are large rockets, you know, many stories tall. You know, it would take you, you know, half a minute to walk all the way around it. And they're building these things every 2 to 3 weeks in tents in South Texas. And that's the kind of thing that we've never seen before in the space industry. And that's why it's really exciting to think that, yeah, we might actually send humans to Mars in these things in the next decade or so, just because they're moving so fast.
Would you go to Mars if they said to you, Eric, it's going to be a 3-year-plus trip for you, up, there, and back? You're going to be there for 3 years. Would you do it?
No, I'd go to the moon, but I don't think I'd go to Mars. You know, I've got a family here on Earth, and
yep, I get it.
Earth is a better planet than Mars, and I salute the pioneers that would make that trip. But I like living here.
You know, they talk about terraforming Mars. We've had Robert Zubrin on from the Mars Society. And, he's got a plan that sure. He said would take about 100 years, but they would create an atmosphere and everything else. But, I mean, is that really the way we want to live? Do we want to live in a bubble for so many years and stuff like that? I wouldn't.
Well, yeah, I probably wouldn't either. And by the way, Bob Zubrin's great. I'm glad you've had him on. But the idea that Musk has and that people like me sort of believe in is that our future lies among the stars. If humanity is really going to thrive as a species, ultimately, you know, we're going to find Earth-like worlds around other stars. There are no other Earth-like worlds in our solar system, and we're not ready to go to the stars yet. So the interim step is to see, you know, sort of to try out settlement on worlds closer to home. And the best one is Mars, and it's not good, right? Its atmosphere is very thin. It's your opening segment. You talked about the perchlorate in the soil that's harmful to humans. There's lots of things that are not great on Mars, but it does have ice at the polar caps. It does have a thin atmosphere. The temperatures aren't extreme like you find on places. So we're going to have to go at some point, and that's the first step. And it won't be pleasant, right? It won't be great, but if we're going to do this, you've got to start somewhere.
After World War II, a group of German scientists went to the Soviet Union and to us, and those that the Soviets got apparently beat us to the punch because they got Sputnik up in 57 before we did and scared the living daylights out of everybody in America. I mean, I was just a kid, but I remember my parents, like, in fear and awe. Oh, my God, they've got a spaceship up there. The thing was no bigger than a basketball. But Wernher von Braun, we got him, and he was, of course, very influential with our space program. Would Musk have gone after a guy like that to try to hire him?
Probably. I mean, he goes after the best possible talent that he can get. One of his earliest hires was a guy named Bülent Altan. He was a Turkish engineer. He was in graduate school at Stanford University. This is back in 2003. And Altan's wife had a good job at Google. He didn't want to move to Los Angeles. So when he interviewed with Musk, Elon said, I heard your wife doesn't want to move to L.A. because she's got a job at Google. Well, I just called Larry, and he said she can work down here. So he called his friend Larry Page,
who runs Google.
To move things over.
Yeah.
There were many stories like that when I would talk to these early employees. So if he thought Wernher von Braun could help him, he would absolutely have gone after Wernher von Braun.
Does Bezos get along with Elon Musk?
They don't talk much. During one of my interviews with Elon was when we were flying from the factory in California to the build site in South Texas, on his jet, and we were talking about. Because Jeff Bezos moves much more slowly, more like a traditional aerospace company. And he had told me, Jeff Bezos that is, that it takes 7 years to build a rocket engine, right? And I was talking to Elon because their first rocket engine, the Merlin, SpaceX had built in less than 3 years and tested. And I said, so I told him what Bezos had said. And Elon laughed and he said, well, that's because Jeff Bezos, frankly, is not a very good engineer. So I think they can kind of respect what each other are doing, and certainly they have the same idea. They both think that the first thing to do is to bring down the cost of launch. So they're both building reusable rockets. But the rivalry is real, and I don't think there's any love lost between them.
Got a little assignment for you, Eric, and that is get Elon Musk to do a two-hour segment with us like you're doing tonight, and I'll bring you on with me, and we'll co-interview the program.
Well, I'll work on it. He doesn't answer to me, unfortunately, George.
give his people the invite, and let's see what happens.
All right, I will.
You never know. I mean, it's the world's largest late night show. He might do it. He might like it.
He might do it. He is up late at night.
Can you imagine him taking calls with listeners too? That would be fun.
You bet. He might be up for it. I'll ask.
So what's new for SpaceX? What's the next projects for them?
The biggest project for them is, without a doubt, Starship. It's this vehicle that's basically two stages. You've got a first stage rocket, this colossal vehicle that has 25 super powerful Raptor engines. And that goes up, and it, like the Falcon 9 rocket, it'll come back down and land.
Wow.
And they're talking about landing it right on the launch pad so they can turn around and launch it again within hours. And then the second part of the vehicle is this Starship, and it's something we've never seen before. It's this fully reusable upper stage. It could carry cargo or people into orbit. And then it could also be, George, refueled in low Earth orbit. So more Starships could launch, fill it up, and then this vehicle could go on to Mars. And you know, we've never done this kind of orbital refueling. We've never seen launches on this kind of scale. And this is a rocket, you know, as powerful as the Saturn V. So it's truly revolutionary. And they're having to break in a lot of new technology to try to bring it about. And so they're having those battles. And so when they have these landings in South Texas, that's part of sort of fly, learn, test, fail, fly, and then finally succeed.
And Richard Branson, he's still in the picture, isn't he?
He is. His ambitions are much, much less. I mean, the Spaceship Two vehicle that he's doing and hopes to fly in space later this year or next year is suborbital. So that only requires about 1% of the energy that an orbital vehicle requires.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's a flight of a few minutes of space versus if you get into orbit, you know, you can fly in orbit for years if you want to.
Super. Stay with us, Eric. We're going to come back and take a final hour to go with you, and that means phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.